Welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show, where we talk about adventure and activism and how sports can change the world. Okay, cool. I'm so excited to be here for a new episode of the Caroline Gleick Show with my friend Molly Kawahata. She was one of my first podcast guests in 2020 when I started the show, and she's a dear friend of mine. She's the former White House policy advisor for clean energy and climate at the Obama White House, which is something I never get sick of saying because it was so cool when I got to meet her at the White House, and she currently has a career in clean energy. She's just one of the most fantastic climate communicators that I know, and I'm always calling her up for advice on how I can improve my climate messaging and ways I can better myself as an activist. And so, Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I always love being here.
I am so excited. And this podcast is brought to you by Climate Power, which is a climate advocacy group focused on building the political will and public support for bold climate action. And so today we are going to catch up about climate, about how we as everyday people can make a difference, what we can do, and specifically as that relates to Build Back Better, the Build Back Better Act. And so, Molly, what is Build Back Better?
So the Build Back Better Act, it's actually President Biden's second half of his economic agenda. And the best part of this is it's truly the most significant climate bill in history. And what will it do? One, we know that it's going to tackle the climate crisis and it'll cut pollution at the rate the science demands, which is huge, right? Everyone's telling us, you know, listen to the scientists. The Build Back Better Act is listening to the scientists. And then the other thing more broadly, and we'll definitely get into this, is it's going to make people's lives better right now. And it's going to do this by lowering costs for working families, seniors, the middle class on things like energy prices and utility bills. And this is huge because the latest projection I've seen is that energy bills are going to go up 34 to 50% this winter.
Wow.
Which is very concerning, right? That's a huge cost, especially for folks that live in a lot of the towns your listeners live in very cold places that have high heating bills to begin with. For low-income families, utility bills are a big part of their income that they have to, that they have to cover. And so this is really big. Things that are going to cut energy prices for everyday people are really important. And then in addition, kind of more broadly, this is going to give childcare, elder care. It's going to reduce the prices of prescription drugs. Ultimately, what it's going to do, it's going to cut taxes for middle-class families. And in the process, we're going to create like thousands of really good-paying clean energy jobs.
Yeah.
And that's huge, right? I'm always talking about like the clean energy economy we're building. In the process, when we're talking about that, it's about putting people back to work. And I actually remember when I was at the Obama White House, I remember President Biden telling us, I remember he said, if there's one thing this administration stands for, it's this. We're growing the middle class and we're trying to give more people a fighting chance of getting into the middle class.
Yeah.
I never forgot that, actually, especially in the climate work we were doing. Everything was had an overlay with economic development and justice. Mm-hmm. And so I think about that often. The Build Back Better Act is that, and also infrastructure more generally. I mean, that is a cornerstone of economic policy in America. And it's also a cornerstone of climate policy in America. So it's very exciting. Everyone should be psyched on this.
It's very exciting. And it's been really fascinating, I guess, living in Park City, Utah, where I am, to see kind of like the erosion, how that erosion of the middle class has accelerated with COVID. You know, it's just kind of mind boggling how the real estate market just kind of went crazy. And combining that, it seems like it's a lot harder for, especially like when I was a young ski bum, I could like move to Salt Lake and find an affordable place to rent and like, you know, live the ski bum lifestyle. But now with, yeah, that kind of erosion of the middle class, it seems like it's a harder and harder dream for young skiers to attain. And it's far beyond skiing affecting it, but that's just an incidental side note that I've noticed in Park City. And I just on a broader level, why is it so important to take climate action right now?
So one thing we know, right, is that America has very high levels of economic injustice. And what goes along with that is racial injustice, climate injustice, health injustice. And one thing actually that's really exciting is this administration is really prioritizing climate justice. And they actually created an initiative called Justice 40. You might have heard of it. What is that? It's a whole of government effort to ensure that federal agencies work with states and local communities to make good on his promise, which is to, by the way, deliver 40% of the overall benefits of investments in climate and clean energy to disadvantaged communities. When we talk about climate justice, and people love throwing around that term, this is what that means. It also means addressing public health, which by definition, climate action does.
Yeah, I guess when it comes to like the broader question too of why we should take action on climate, why it's so important, it's like a moral imperative. I think about kind of my trajectory as an activist. And when I was in college, like I really struggled feeling like the weight of the world, seeing like people experiencing homelessness and seeing income inequality and just seeing gender inequality and all of these big issues. And I really struggled for a long time to find my lever because there's like pollution and all these things and it felt really overwhelming. And when I started to do more deeper digging and learning, I realized climate is the lens through which we can tackle all of these issues and we can incorporate them all and to create a better world, a better society. And so it kind of really helped me focus on, you know, that like intense, I had like this intense depression and anxiety. I mean, I still have it and it really helps to drive my activism because like advocating for policies like this, it makes me feel like I can do something to tackle those like seemingly insurmountable problems. And so I think that when we think about the problems that our world is facing right now, that taking action on climate, it helps people and the environment and protects public lands and it's good for our health and well-being. And a lot of the other stuff in this bill, like the peripheral stuff, which isn't peripheral at all, like the investments for childcare and everything for parents, like I think it can really help to have, you know, a big avenue to create the kinds of change we want to see in society.
Exactly. It's about strengthening the middle class, right? And that's what we're all trying to do through climate action. And to take a step back kind of in what you were getting at with like the environmental justice component, one thing I'm trying to get folks to understand is like when we act on climate, we improve the quality of life of everybody. And just to get back to kind of Justice 40 and what this is intended to address, the intersection at which climate change becomes climate justice is public health. This is not something we're talking about enough when we talk about climate change or climate justice, right? We talk about polar bears in the Arctic. We talk about melting glaciers, environmental frames that, you know, kind of everyday folks in a country with the income inequality we have don't have the luxury about thinking about things happening thousands and thousands of miles away. What we know is that, you know, when I say this is about public health, it means this, which is that communities of color in America are significantly likelier to have to live near things like fossil fuel power plants, refineries, toxic waste sites, polluting highways. And what does that mean? Like, what's the impact that has? One example is that 1 in 10 Black children in America have asthma. I'm going to say that again. 10% of American Black children have asthma. And whenever I talk about this, I get fact-checked. It's the number one thing I get fact-checked on. Like, people don't believe me because it's such a scary statistic, right? It's overwhelmingly horrifying to actually think 10%. You don't hear about those stats in public health. And this is in thanks to the NAACP's like incredible research and documenting these truths, like things that this community has known about for decades. They've been fighting for clean air and clean water for their children long before Al Gore made a film, long before climate change was a term, right? And so what we know is that initiatives like Justice 40 and what the Build Back Better Act is intended to do, it's intended to address these kinds of disparities. And the best part is that when you address them through climate change, you also address pollution.
Yes.
Right? Our electricity sector, we often talk about climate change, the impacts of climate change are felt most by, you know, these communities that are disadvantaged. But the other thing is that the sources of climate change are impacting most these disadvantaged communities. This is what we mean, right? Like, you can look at Richmond, California. The Chevron refinery is there, and they live in the shadows of it. The community is forced to live in the shadows of that refinery. They have some of the highest asthma rates in the country. that impacts their very high hospitalization rates. In fact, if you are living in an area with high pollution, which impacts your public health, 87% of the folks that live in those areas live in areas that are also underserved from a public health perspective. So when you get sick because of your air, it's harder to get good care to deal with it. That's what Justice 40 is about. So like the linchpin of environmental justice is really getting at the fact that these are just not natural occurrences that happen, right? That communities of color have much higher asthma rates, that have higher rates of lung disease, heart disease, premature death, that they have more missed school days, missed work days. That's just not natural occurrences, right? Those are political decisions that went into deciding some people's public health is expendable. And others need to be protected.
Yeah.
So that's really kind of, you know, like that's what we're talking about when we talk about environmental justice. That's what the Biden administration is addressing through Justice 40.
Right. And I think like when we talk about climate and we talk about reducing emissions, like what are emissions? But when you understand that emissions are pollution, the same pollution that contaminates our air and water, it makes it a lot easier to understand. We see this same kinds of public health risks in the Salt Lake Valley when we have really gnarly inversions. And it's even disproportionately felt by people more from marginalized groups who live like further on the west side. And so there's overall the bad air in Salt Lake takes 2 years off of our lives. But on the west side, it's 5 years. So we're dying 2 to 5 years earlier. And there's also a 16% increased rate of miscarriage. So that's almost 1 in 5 babies that does not make it to the world because of air pollution. And so I think that the Build Back Better is really a big deal because we're talking about 10 times more emissions reduction, more pollution reduction than any other legislation in the US.
It's a huge deal. It's so... This is good. I like that you're bringing up Salt Lake City because that's a reality you live in. What is the difference between the east side and the west side in those communities?
The east side is like there's more trees, so it's typically doesn't get as hot and it doesn't have the same kind of industrial pollution. Like there aren't the big refineries. And I mean, there's on the west side, we also have the Kennecott Copper Mine, which is the largest open pit mine in the world. And that is another issue, but there's a lot of different sources of pollution. And so definitely we see much worse air quality on the west side. Yeah, but I'm not like a total expert in those dynamics of how that all plays out.
Yeah, but what about the communities, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the east side is definitely a lot more white and upper. Now it's very upper middle class and upper class and upper class because the housing market has gone crazy. Yeah, and the west side is definitely more communities of color.
It's that story every single time.
Yes.
And actually, I had a really shocking experience when I was in Utah. So I actually went to Topaz, Utah, which is in the desert, to actually visit the site where my grandparents were interned during World War II for being Japanese American. Whole other, we could do its own podcast on that. But I'm in this town, small town, and at night I just start coughing and I start looking around for my inhaler. I get out of bed. I'm like looking around for my inhaler. And at one point I stop because I'm like, I haven't needed an inhaler in a long time. I have very mild asthma. Why am I looking for this? Like, what's happening? So I got on Google Maps and you're looking around and then there it is. Every time, 10 miles away, there's a coal-fired power plant.
Wow.
And then you look at the data, right? Median income of the community below average. And then who's the largest employer in town? It's the same story every time. Hospitalization rates above average, childhood asthma rates above average. This is what we're talking about. And I know that's a reality for a lot of folks in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, it is a public health crisis. And it also just causes so many other ripple effects, you know, like the rising rates of healthcare. And then as people get sick, it's like they have to miss work or take care of others. And so it really has like a huge ripple effect that, you know, it makes it hard for people to achieve the American dream. you know, there's that saying, like, if people would just, that like notion, right, that you can just pick yourself up by the bootstraps and like get out there and do it. But
and what if you don't have boots?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like the public health implications and the things it can do for children and for parents and for all of us, you know, like our health matters.
Yeah. And this is the thing in America with the levels of income inequality we're facing today, the levels of racial and economic disparities. The reality is that like you used to be able to like work a job and play by the rules and survive. That's changed, right? Like one job isn't enough for a lot of families to survive. They're working 2-3 jobs. Moms are making decisions on what they can purchase in their groceries or between their child's health care and feeding their family. When did that happen? They're playing by the rules. They're doing everything right. Something happened, right? And so the Build Back Better Act is intended to really strengthen and focus on the middle class.
Yeah. And the Build Back Better also has legislation. It will target incentives to grow the domestic supply chains for solar, wind, and other critical industries in communities on the front lines of the energy transition. And so I just wanted to kind of stress that with U.S. leadership comes U.S. jobs and like a return to kind of doing things here. And I always think about this experience I had when I was at a federal hearing about coal leasing on public lands. And as a lot of these hearings were in Utah at the time, it was just filled with like 500 coal miners. You're at these things for hours, sometimes waiting for your spot in line to speak. So during some of the breaks, I would talk to other folks and I wanted to learn about them, hear their stories. And they wanted to hear about my story and they were completely perplexed by my chosen career and how I was able to do that. And I wanted to know what their life was like. And so I met these two young men who live down in Carbon County in Utah. And they've been coal miners and their parents, their dads were, and their grandparents were coal miners. And I asked them if they liked their job and they said that they actually really didn't like it and that they would take a job installing rooftop solar tomorrow if they could find one. And I don't want to speak for all coal miners and all coal communities because this is two men I met. But with that being said, that worker transition piece and bringing back American, you know, leadership for solar, wind, and these other industries. Like, I think there's just something about that for me and for them and probably for a lot of us that just, it feels really good. It feels like what we should be doing.
Yeah. This is, I mean, a couple things there. So one, I think this is one thing environmentalists need to be very mindful of is never vilifying workers and knowing and understanding kind of where these communities are coming from. These communities have relied on coal and coal jobs for generations. And so that's a reality, right? That's something that when we talk about a just transition, this is part of that. You don't just throw these communities behind. So there's a lot, like there's a big interplay with labor in the climate movement. And for anybody that's interested in this, I encourage you to check out the Blue Green Alliance, which is this amazing organization that's very much focused on workers in the climate and energy transition. And then on top of that, I mean, yeah, so this is my favorite thing about acting on climate. So we used to say this at the Obama White House, that climate change represents the greatest economic opportunity of the 21st century. It's also the greatest crisis we face, but it's economic opportunity, right? I'm trying to associate climate action with economic opportunity. Because this is exciting. It's amazing. Like what you're saying, like we're putting people back to work in the process. The clean energy economy has so much innovation and economic development associated with it that it's something we should absolutely embrace. That's what the U.S. is trying to do. That's what Build Back Better is about, right? And another point about manufacturing. Yes, this is another one of my favorite things is like advanced manufacturing is very important. And we need to keep those jobs in America. And clean energy and a lot of next generation clean energy technology provides us with a lot of those opportunities. Now, if you let go of manufacturing, if we just like throw that sector away, we just let it go, well, also goes innovation, also goes R&D. They go together. This is a really important point folks don't realize. And these are important jobs. Now, we also need a lot of other economic safeguards. This is very important, right? Just beyond kind of emissions policy and clean energy policy, there are other economic components of the clean energy transition that we need to ensure we're pushing very hard on, like just transition policies, many of which are being addressed in this bill.
Yes. And at the end of the day, I think, like, as I've been on my climate activist journey, I've gone through all these different things, right? Like, from my first thing I tried to do was like make art out of garbage and plastic waste. Like, that was one of my first things. Then I had like a little pop-up vintage thrift store because I was like, fast fashion, that's like the enemy, right? I've gone through all these waves. And now, like, I'm working on this policy. I'm working on stuff at the state level and the city level. And on my home, I'm working to like electrify, and we added solar, and we're going to install a heat pump. And the cool thing, and I acknowledge that I have a lot of privilege to be able to do those things and that not everybody does. But what this framework will do is like give tax credits for people who want to do things like install heat pumps. And heat pump technology is really cool. We're about to install one now. It's a way to heat and cool your house using electricity. And at the end of the day, what happens is your bills are a lot lower and you're more comfortable. So it's saving people money, but it's also more comfortable.
It's a better product. In a lot of ways.
It's a better product. Yes. And so I'm really excited about heat pumps.
That's awesome. And yeah, I mean, again, very high upfront costs for those things. But for those that have a lot of resources, electrifying your home, that's a powerful thing to do. That's one of the, like, that's a very hard to decarbonize area for existing homes. Now, codes and standards, you know, we can address new construction, and a lot of towns and communities are doing that. Existing buildings, that's very difficult. And so that's where kind of individual action of what folks can do is powerful. I encourage people who have those resources to check them out.
But yeah, it will be great to see some of these federal incentives kick in too, because it is a heavy lift and it's like a lot of time too, like getting these bids. And yeah, it's been very time consuming. So I wanted to just give a quick rundown of some of the other highlights in the Build Back Better Act. So there's universal pre-K for 3 and 4. There's a cap for childcare at 7% of income. There's ways of making elder care more affordable, reducing healthcare premiums for 9 million Americans by expanding tax credit, and expanding Medicaid coverage to 4 million uninsured people, as well as for older Americans. So I just wanted to touch on those.
And this stuff is huge because it's like people are suffering in this country. These are the types of policies that work to take the boot off your neck, right? That work to give you a little more space, a little less anxiety. That's what this stuff is intended to do. And that's kind of the impact on like everyday folks. These are not policies that are intended to help the 1%. They are focused exclusively on the middle class. And those are the folks that are going to really benefit most from this.
And I get personally really excited about the things for childcare because, like, I mean, I don't have a kid, but I do think about it. And it seems incredibly stressful. You know, like, I want to be able to continue to pursue my career as a professional ski mountaineer. As I want to do this till I'm like 80 or 100. Like, I could do something else in between climbing big mountains if I need to take a break for a couple of years. But like, this is my dream and I always want to do it. And I'm going to need childcare because like, I can't take always my baby or my child with me. It seems like a crazy amount. I've heard some of my friends be like, as soon as you guys are trying to conceive, you need to like sign your kid up for the daycare list because the good ones are literally that far out. So I think that these investments could really help support parents and especially mothers, women, to stay in the workplace. And when we have more women in leadership positions, especially as elected officials, we see better climate policy.
Yeah, totally.
It helps mothers and it helps all parents of all genders.
Exactly.
You know, like, and I think that's a really important point, is like, we got to support parents. We need kids, and yeah, they're really important for the economy. Children are. So anyway, I think the childcare stuff is really cool. And the other thing I just wanted to talk about is the cost. Yes, it does cost a lot, but it will create jobs, save money, and it will be fully paid for, and it won't be paid for by taxing the middle class. But when you think about the cost of climate action, I think it's also really important to think about inaction, which is the alternative.
That's what I was about to say.
Right. And like, what do you think are some of the costs of inaction, Molly?
Do you know how much it costs if we don't act on climate?
Yeah, like wildfires. Like, that's a huge cost if like a bunch of houses burn.
Okay, the impacts of climate change from like the adaptation and resilience perspective. So like we're talking wildfires, droughts, hurricanes. I don't like focusing too much on this because like what we're trying to do is take action and we have to like prepare for these things and be aware of them. But yes, like loss of life, damage to property, impacts to our economic system, impacts to our food system. These costs are massive. I mean, we're like refugees. People are going to leave where they live because they literally cannot live there. There are portions of the U.S. where that's going to happen way sooner than people think. So there's going to be a lot of immigration issues. I mean, there are costs beyond what we're able to even imagine. And so the act on climate change, I mean, the cost of acting on climate change, it's a good deal.
Yeah, I remember just reading something about like flooding in New York City with sea level rise and how much it will cost to like try to divert all the ocean rise and all the different things they'd have to construct. And that's just one city. And it's like billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. So yeah, not to go down the doom and gloom.
No, but in the other component of this, again, I always go back to public health and I talk a lot about, you know, the psychology and neuroscience of reframing and our climate communications. When we look at this from a public health perspective, when we reframe entirely, right? Like, let me give you an example of another public health frame is that President Obama was getting attacked for under healthcare and they were saying Obamacare costs too much. So that was a frame they created. And rather than saying, no, Obamacare does not cost too much, where he still, that, you know, that would still be wiring and advancing in people's brains the association between his healthcare plan and cost, unaffordability, right? He turned it around and he said, healthcare is a human right.
Yes.
Now, what's associated with that? There is no association with cost. You don't put a cost or a price on a human right.
Yeah.
You start the debate in a whole different place. And that's what people do when they're saying, you know, people say acting on climate change costs too much. People often respond by saying, no, it doesn't cost too much. You know, in fact, we're doing a little bit of that here. Now, when we say that, we're still advancing an association between climate action and like a herd economy.
Yeah.
When we reframe and like, let's break that down a little bit. When you talk about that, there's an association with compromise and balance, right? You're trying to say, how do I strike a compromise for us to act on climate change with like the sacrifices we're going to be having to make? And if you reframe it in terms of public health, like the fact that the Build Back Better Act is fundamentally about protecting people's well-being mm-hmm. and the well-being of their children and future generations when we think about climate change. When you reframe it that way, there is no association of balance and compromise. When you talk about people's health and the health and well-being of your children, you do not find balance in the health and well-being of your children. You do not compromise on the health and well-being of your children. You fight for it at all costs. That's a more effective frame. And when we respond to the conservative frame by talking about cost, really, we're saying, you know, like you hear this anytime people make the case for climate action, environmentalists make the case, they say, climate action is worth it. We need to act because of X, Y, Z. What we're doing when we say that, we're really saying climate action is worth the cost, worth the consequences, worth the sacrifice. That's inherent in the frame we're using. That's what happens when we respond to anti-climate narratives. So reframing this in terms of public health, which really fundamentally this bill is about, it's going to be a more effective way to sell it to the American people. And it's more effective in just like how I think about it. This is why I care about systemic change. This is what that's doing.
Yeah. And the climate crisis is literally life or death. You know, people are going to die. More people. I mean, people already are.
And also, it's about saving lives.
It's about saving lives.
Saving our children, right? This is why I tell people, I'm like, why do we keep saying planet? Can we stop? Like, where did we start doing that? Okay. One, when did we start using like an outer space metaphor to talk about this? We're not trying to save the planet. The planet will recover. It'll go back. It'll be here. We are trying to save our children, our families, our community, ourselves, and future generations.
Yeah. That's 16% of babies that are miscarried when they are in utero because of, yes, we are saving them.
And the other part of this is like, I'm fine if people just want to say pollution.
Yeah.
That's what climate change is.
Yes.
If people just want to call it pollution, I'm fine with that. Don't even use the term because that's what it's about. And there's not a person out there that doesn't care about the health and well-being of their children or who wants to breathe dirty air.
Yeah.
What could be more fundamental to human survival than air, like clean air, your ability to complete, like just breathe? And to think that that's currently in this country a privilege and not a right is kind of unconscionable.
It is. Absolutely.
So that's why we need policies like that, right? When we talk about systemic change, this is what that is.
Wow. Yes. 100%. Okay. So Molly, is climate actually solvable?
Yes. Oh my God. I love talking about this. This is the story that's not being told. When you think about the cause, the problem, and the sources of climate change, nobody is telling you that there is an endpoint. It is solvable. And we are well on our way. There's a promised land here. It's the zero carbon economy of the future. When we think about the work of systemic change, right, which I always talk about, of climate mitigation policy, it is about curbing greenhouse gases at the source, at the sector. We're talking about like double digit percentage cuts. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we are doing, what we're going to do, right? And it's fundamentally premised on mainly addressing the electricity sector. Because when we address the electricity sector, we also address the transportation sector. We also address portions of industry. We also address buildings. Like all the other sectors get combined into, I mean, we also have to address other sectors, absolutely. But like, this is exciting. That's what mitigation is doing. So I love telling people that there's an endpoint and we are well on our way. Because that's actually a more effective way. Not only is it true, it's also a more effective way to get people on board. So we don't just say it because it feels good, but oh, also it happens to feel good. Climate action is exciting. It's inspiring. And people would always ask me when I was at the White House, they were like, isn't your job depressing? And I'd be like, what are you talking about? They were like, the more you learn about this issue, right, the more overwhelming it is. I was like, yeah, there's one way to look at it. But for me, every day I wake up, the more I work on this issue, the more hope I feel.
Yes.
I feel that today. I feel so much hope for what we can accomplish. Because again, when we act on climate change, we improve everybody's quality of life. We're putting people back to work. We're investing in communities that have been left behind. We're saving lives. We're cleaning up the air for everybody. What could be more worthy?
Yes.
That's why we need this bill.
Yes. And we really need everybody's help in terms of getting calls into your representatives right now and to ask them to pass the Build Back Better Act and deliver the climate action we desperately need. And so to do that, Climate Power has created a really easy way to do that. And so you text the code SCIENCE to 434-266-8464. And this is all in the show notes. And that will take you directly. They will call you back from that and transfer you via a switchboard to your elected officials, to their lines. And you can leave a message or hopefully you can get through and ask them, tell them that we need to pass the Build Back Better Act.
Focus on systemic change. This is what that is.
This is what that is. And it's takes maybe 2 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. I always like to practice what I'm going to say before I get on the call. But there's a really easy script. And so, yes, it's really easy. Ask them to pass the Build Back Better Act. So there you have it.
Awesome.
Yes, Molly, thank you so much. And thank you, everybody who has listened. And thank you to Climate Power for sponsoring.
Thanks for having me, Caroline.
Yes, awesome. I can't wait to, hopefully we can get out for an adventure this winter.
Yeah, I can't wait. You're definitely going to come ice climbing.
Yes, and you're going to come skiing. Okay, and also, yeah, give Climate Power at Climate Power on Instagram a follow and follow Molly because she's always dropping so much good wisdom on the gram. So it's at Molly, M-O-L-L-Y, Kawahata, K-A-W-A-H-A-T-A.
I am resilient. I trust the movement. I negate the chaos. Uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again and again. I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks to Avery Sandak for his help with the audio on today's episode. To my partner, Rob Lee, for being extra quiet while recording in the house today. And to Rising Appalachia for graciously providing the music for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate and review it so other people can find it. Until next time.